This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Doug Bell, and I'd like to welcome you all to the Beloved Community Group. We've been doing this work now for about a year and a half. And today we have a great speaker, somebody that I'm really excited about. I've known him for about a year and a half to 2 years, I think. And we're very fortunate that he decided to move from Richmond, Virginia to Austin. And that was a great thing for us. So it was at the time that he came, I was kind of struggling around trying to figure out what we were going to do. And Rob came here with all this experience and in both, you know, healing, racial healing, but all kinds of healing programs that he's been a professional of. And so we've asked him to speak today and talk about his approach for trust building and truth and reconciliation. So Rob was in Richmond for, I think, about 40 years, right? Yeah. Okay. In Richmond, for those of you that don't know, is the capital of the Confederacy. And one of the important churches there that Rob was involved in was St. Paul's, which actually was attended by such people as the president of the Confederacy. And I think Robert E. Lee probably was there too times. So it's been a different history than ours, although we have some similarities in the history. Incidentally, we have another group working at St. David's who has just did a presentation this morning about our history during the Civil War for St. David's. And that's a very interesting story too. But today we're here to talk to Rob and let him tell us about the way in which the people in Richmond, Virginia started doing this kind of healing, this racial healing program. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Rob. He'll just replace me in this window, and I'll let him get started.
Well, hi, everyone. Very good to be with you. Thank you, Doug, for that welcome. As Doug said, we just moved to Austin 2 years ago. My wife, Susan, who's also here on the call, I can see up there on the screen. There she's waving. So we're just beginning to get to know the great state of Texas. Today I'm going to talk about trust, racial healing, and transformation. Trust, because without trust, it's going to be virtually impossible to generate the will and the partnerships needed to tackle the great challenges facing our communities in this country. Racial healing, because racism hurts all of us. All of us need to be healed. And transformation, because the energy for deep structural change requires a moral and a spiritual transformation in the human spirit. Now, all across this country and in many parts of the world right now, people are rising up against a history of oppression, discrimination, and violence against people of color. Here at home, the COVID epidemic has dramatically exposed the vast inequities in pay and access to healthcare. At the same time, we've seen people pay millions to ride on the first commercial flights to space. Perhaps nothing illustrates more starkly the gap between our technical prowess and our moral failure as a nation to value the humanity of every human being. Why is it that the richest country in the world invests less in its people when it comes to a living wage, universal healthcare, early childhood education, affordable housing, and basic infrastructure than any other advanced country? It's certainly not for lack of resources. The greatest challenges we face are not economic or technical. They're rooted primarily in our inability to overcome a false hierarchy, a false racial hierarchy, a hierarchy of human value. Now, books such as How to Be an Anti-Racist, White Fragility, and Caste have topped the bestseller list over the last years. Large numbers of white Americans are better informed about racism than ever. Faith communities are engaging in deep conversations about their history and their responsibility. Numerous groups offer training. Corporations constantly use themes of diversity and inclusion in their marketing. However, as some commentators have noted, many people appear more eager to learn about books, to learn about race through books and workshops than to actually make changes in their own lives that might infringe on their areas of privilege. Today in Austin and in many cities, Black Lives Matter and other signs embracing diversity adorn tree-lined streets where neighbors of color are conspicuously absent. Is it possible that the biggest obstacle to racial equity is not overt racism, but well-meaning folk who resist risking their privileges and who focus more on performative anti-racism and cultural battles? Slogans are easy. Living in ways that move our communities towards equity is hard. Now, when I first met Dr. Gail Christopher, who at the time was a senior vice president at the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, she was guiding the institution to commit to addressing structural racism as a necessity in its mission to enable vulnerable children to thrive. I often heard her say that being anti something is not enough. We must be for something. That something, she said, was a combination of truth, healing, and transformation, and a recognition of the unique value of every human being. She said, healing is a process in which we have those rare moments and gifts of awe and appreciation of the perceived other, and when we see so much more of who we are and what we could be. So in this context, what is the role and responsibility of people of faith? I'd like to share some experiences and perspectives drawn from 40 years that my wife and I spent working with a remarkably diverse multi-sector network in Richmond, and maybe to suggest some key steps for building healthy, inclusive communities. Some of you may have seen a few weeks back the documentary on PBS entitled How the Monuments Came Down. It's a remarkable documentary which describes the process of removing monuments of Confederate avenues of Confederate generals on our famed Monument Avenue in Richmond. What struck me was that most of the people interviewed and featured are people who have been in the trenches for a long time. Many of them are people that I've known and collaborated with. They're people who've had the courage to do the sustaining work, not necessarily the louder voices or the protesters. Just a few weeks ago, Michael Paul Williams, a columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for his, quote, penetrating and historically insightful columns that led to Richmond, a former capital of the Confederacy, through the painful and complicated process of dismantling the city's monuments to white supremacy. In the words of his editor, Michael Paul has been spurring Richmond towards an awakening since 1992, when he became the first Black columnist hired at an institution that endorsed massive resistance, unquote. This really illustrates my first criteria for sustainable change. Any deeply rooted transformative process takes time. The network in Richmond, Virginia has been working steadily for 3 decades. Something like racism, which was a central factor since the founding of this country, is not going to be solved tomorrow. It takes people with passion and persistence. Secondly, we can't reconcile before we reckon. We must have an honest reckoning with our history, and perhaps even more importantly, an honest reckoning with the legacy of that history. The structures, the policies that we are part of today, We must acknowledge the affirmative action for whites that was in effect since the 17th century. The land grants, the bank loans for mortgages and other benefits that the government handed out for generations exclusively to white Americans, and which has resulted in a huge wealth disparity of 10 to 1. As Heather McGee writes in her powerful book, The Sum of Us, programs that were created originally without regard for cost and which would pay for themselves in terms of economic growth when the goal was to build a white middle class suddenly became unaffordable when it came to supporting a future middle class that would be majority people of color. The relentless pace of gentrification, astronomical house prices pushes up property taxes, making many cities increasingly unlivable for anyone on a modest income. Restrictive zoning laws apply to 3/4 of the residential land in this country. And as someone wrote the other day, single family exclusive zoning has become known as the new redlining. Or if we take education, the columnist Nicholas Kristof notes, the United States embraces a public education system based on local financing that ensures that poor kids go to poor schools and rich kids to rich schools. He writes that educated white Americans are repulsed at the history of separate and unequal drinking fountains for Black Americans, but seem comfortable with the Jim Crow financing system for resulting in unequal schools for Black children. Perhaps that's because we and our children have a stake in this unequal system. My friend Stephanie Hawley is Austin's first equity officer for its public schools. Her first report highlighted, quote, the powerful impact of white families with agency and social capital on issues such as school closures and redistricting, and the frequent lack of voice by Black and Latino parents. She commented, this is what 21st century racism looks like. Thirdly, the change process must engage all sectors, business, government, community action groups, education, the arts, faith-based organizations. Isolated efforts will not work. Therefore, we need to build strategic partnerships. John Gardner describes this as, quote, networks of responsibility drawn from all segments coming together to create a wholeness that incorporates diversity. Now, this may mean reaching out to people or institutions from whom we feel alienated. We need to be willing to move out of our comfort zones. Fourth, we need to listen carefully to the hopes and fears of people, including those with whom we strongly disagree. How do we create a welcoming environment for honest story sharing? Learn to listen to stories without judgment. As humans, our brains are wired for story. The columnist David Brooks writes, the collapse of trust, the rise of animosity, these are emotional, not intellectual problems. The real problem is in our system of producing shared stories. And if a country can't tell narratives in which everybody finds an honorable place, then righteous anger, righteous rage will drive people towards tribal narratives that tear us apart. And fifth, there is something that each one of us can do. It will be different for each one of us. May seem like a small step, but each of us can follow that inner voice of truth when we ask, what is the right next thing? The most important space for my wife, Susan, and me is the first hour of the day, our quiet time, when we seek God's direction for our lives. We jot down our thoughts, share them with each other, and pray about them. This is an indispensable foundation. It counters fear, peer pressure, and the stress of daily life. Helps us to guide our decisions about our relationship, our family, our finances, our friendships, and our connections to the wider community. We think of this as a time of connection, correction, and direction. For us, it meant investing our family in the community, to live in a diverse neighborhood, and for our three sons to participate in the city's public schools at a time when most whites were leaving the city or leaving the system. It was not simply about what we could get out of the school system, to ensure that our boys got the best education. It was about what we as a family could contribute and how could we as parents be as concerned about the education of every child as our own. My wife and I have worked for most of our lives with Initiatives of Change. It's a worldwide movement of people of diverse cultures and backgrounds who are committed to the transformation of society through changes in human motives and behaviors, starting with their own. I'm going to share a few stories from our experiences in Richmond and illustrate it with some pictures. So let me just see if we can do this. Let me slide that in. There we go. I think we're good. By the way, this is a cover of my book, Trust Building, An Honest Conversation on Race Reconciliation and Responsibility. And some of the stories that I'm going to share are in this book. Now, as Doug said, Richmond is a city that symbolizes, in many ways, America's history of racial oppression and division. Was the first state in the nation to institutionalize slavery. It was the largest domestic interstate slave market in the United States in the first half of the 19th century, when more than 300,000 women, children, and men were sold down the river to the plantations in the Deep South. And of course, when the Civil War broke out, Richmond became the capital of the Confederate States. We then had 100 years of American apartheid following the war. In 1977, African Americans finally won a majority on the city council. And in a surprising way, in recent decades, Richmond has become a seedbed for interracial dialogue and healing in a process engaging all sectors of the community. Cities across the US have looked to Richmond as a leader in this work of reconciliation. The story of how that came about is the topic of my book. The day that we moved into our home, an African-American woman came to the door to welcome us to the neighborhood. Audrey Burton and her husband, Collie, lived directly across the street. They were civil rights activists who had led the voter registration drive that resulted to the 1977 Black majority on the city council. We quickly became friends as we shared our different experiences. The Burtons were carrying the scars of racial oppression. They were also dissatisfied with the usual approaches to community change. I remember Collie Burton saying, "You know, we spent so much effort changing structures, but we had to keep going back and doing it again because we did not change the hearts of people." Audrey grew up in Louisiana, the daughter of a Pentecostal minister. She said there'd been a buildup of pain, anxiety, and frustration caused by racism, by the way I'd been socialized and shaped by society. There was a need in myself to release a drowning spirit. She and Collie began to experiment with regular times of reflection. Many years later, she told a group of community leaders, "I had to reconstruct my whole model to become free of hostility, anger, hate, and frustration. The people we meet at the community level are full of these things. It was a spiritual transformation, not an intellectual one. Rather than constant confrontation, I learned to be quiet, to reconnect. My behavior and language changed. Way down, deep inside, God called me by name." The Burton home became a place of welcome, refreshment, and inspiration for people of all backgrounds. Now, over the next few years, they and others, both Black and white, broke open Richmond's often segregated social life by hosting potluck dinners in homes across the region. Over fried chicken, spaghetti, ham biscuits, prejudices dissolved, friendships formed, sometimes a community later, a police chief, school superintendent, or county supervisor would join the group for informal conversation and a rare opportunity to meet with people who are not pushing an agenda. In unexpected ways, potlucks led to new partnerships. And one new relationship in particular stirred citywide interest. The Burtons decided to welcome, to extend a welcome to a senior white city administrator whom they deeply distrusted and whom they suspected of racism. Mr. Howe Todd had a distinguished 40-year career in local government, but he and Collie Burton had clashed publicly over public policy issues and the allocation of community block grants. Well, the Burtons decided to invite Todd and his wife to a barbecue in their home. It was the start of an unusual friendship. They agreed to talk honestly. Some months later, an African-American executive of a nonprofit organization remarked to me, "Howe Todd used to be known as a person who never listened. Whenever I went into a meeting with him, I always felt the cards were stacked, that the decisions were already made. Now he really listens to what I have to say." People right across the city took note of this new relationship. There are many other examples, such examples in the book. These stories illustrate an important principle. Each of us needs to take an honest inventory of our own lives. Howard Thurman, the great theologian and civil rights leader, once wrote, "The root of what I condemn in others is found at long last in the soil of my own backyard. What I seek to eradicate in society, I must first eradicate in my own heart and life." There is no substitute for this. And we found that the demonstration, the living demonstration of changed lives and changed relationships, such as those I described, proved more powerful than engaging in exhaustive analysis of the problems or simply advocating for others to change. As a young liberal activist from Europe, because I come from Scotland originally, my dad was a shipyard worker and a trade unionist. I arrived in Richmond and I found myself reacting intensely to the conservative environment of Richmond in those days. My worldview and experiences were dramatically different from many of the people I was meeting. And I learned a lot from a black lay preacher whose name was John Coleman. And John used to say, "You have to build a bridge of trust that is strong enough to bear the weight of the truth that you are trying to deliver." And I realized it was not my job to judge anyone, that I might actually learn something from some of the people I found so difficult. This insight made it possible for people of all backgrounds, both liberal and conservative, to feel welcome in the process and to feel that they had a valued contribution to make. And from such beginnings, a network known as Hope in the City emerged, became known as a space where honest conversation could take place and where individuals could make courageous personal choices to move beyond their prejudices and hurts and take constructive action. And in 1993, this led to the first ever public walk through the city's racial history, probably the first to take place in this country, as a matter of fact. When people of all backgrounds walked together to mark places previously too painful or too shameful to remember. In the following years, universities, libraries, museums formed a consortium committed to telling the whole of Richmond's history honestly. Plans for a major museum and heritage center are now underway at the site of the former slave market. It's going to be a $100 million project. Our former governor, who, by the way, happened to be a Republican, pledged $11 million of state funds. And the city allocated another $8 million. Over the years, hundreds of dialogue circles and public forums convened across the city. We developed a model for honest conversation and healing that was adopted by many other cities and states across the country. And we were called on by the White House to help write a dialogue guide for Bill Clinton's race initiative. Some of you have taken part in similar healing circles and dialogues here at St. David's, and I know that there are more planned for this fall. We also approached the local newspaper, which was notorious for its racist policies over the years. It was a strong advocate for segregation. And we invited the editors to support a vision of Richmond as a national leader in racial healing. To our surprise, they responded positively. Editors and reporters took part in history walks and community dialogues. Over the years, news coverage changed markedly. And we ended up actually co-hosting major public events together. In July 2015, a column for the New York Times, Isabel Wilkerson, the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, wrote, "The day after the flag went down in South Carolina, an editorial in the Richmond Times-Dispatch made the stunning declaration that it was finally time for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission and that Virginia should take the lead. Accounting has not occurred," the paper wrote. "The half remains untold. This is precisely what history demands and what this moment requires. Perhaps a new reconstruction could truly take hold and inspire the rest of the country if it sprang from the region that resisted it in the first place," unquote. And as I mentioned earlier, Michael Paul Williams recently won a Pulitzer Prize for his writing on how the monuments came down. In 2011, Hope in the Cities and its allies launched a citywide project using census data by a highly respected university professor to illustrate the correlation between race and concentrated poverty. We looked at the Richmond city plans, very similar to the 1928 Austin city plans, which I've seen, which redlined large sections of the city. And on this map here, you can see the green sections, which are regarded as the most favorable, and the red sections, which are unfavorable and where bank loans were not available, which were, of course, largely populated by people of color. We looked at the decision to build an interstate highway through the heart of the Black business community, destroying hundreds of homes, businesses, and houses of worship. And if you look at the map today of poverty, which is the dark this color, it correlates very closely with the redlining which went on in that previous slide. We also looked at the percentage of students eligible for free and reduced lunch and where they were situated around the city. And we looked at access to public transportation. On this particular slide, you can see blue dots, which represent where all the new jobs are, and the purple lines represent the transportation lines. Very evident that, in fact, we had a big lack of access to public transportation for many of the entry-level jobs. We put all this into a video. We created the dialogues around this, our team did something like 100 presentations all around the metropolitan region. This provided a platform for the mayor to launch the city's first anti-poverty commission. At least 50% of the members were people who themselves lived in deprived neighborhoods. And this in turn resulted in the creation of a permanent office of community wealth building. It occurs to me that maybe Austin would benefit from some similar type of action. As Doug said, an important player in all of this has been St. Paul's Episcopal Church, which my wife attended all of our years in Richmond. St. Paul's sits directly across the street from the Virginia State Capitol. And for generations, the movers and shakers have worshiped there. At the time of the Civil War, it was known as the Church of the Confederacy. And in fact, in April 1865, Jefferson Davis was worshiping there when he was told the city was no longer defendable. Following the shooting at Emmanuel EME Church in Charleston, St. Paul's launched a History and Reconciliation Initiative. It involved a deep dive into the archives which revealed the extent of the congregation's involvement in Richmond's slave economy. Its promotion of a lost cause mythology and racial hierarchy, as well as significant work in recent decades to promote dialogue and to address needs in education and housing. Our historians, Chris Graham and Elizabeth O'Leary, told us that the resources made from the church, that the resources that made the church came directly from the profits of factories and businesses built on the backs of enslaved African Americans. Graham says that little is known about the people who built the church, but quote, this story is less about slavery, is less about how slavery built the church and more about how the church built race. St. Paul supported a widely held theology that claimed God ordained racial inequality and that it was the moral duty of whites to govern blacks. Graham says they defined the enslavement of humans not as an act of violence, but as a benevolence which they justified by their Christian faith. People at St. Paul's were, quote, fully invested emotionally, financially, spiritually in the Civil War. And after the war, the congregation installed iconography of the lost cause and used magnificent stained glass windows to tell a false narrative of former glory, which denied slavery as the primary cause of the war. An early example of fake news. Members of St. Paul's were delegates to the 1902 Virginia Constitution, which disenfranchised huge numbers of African Americans through poll taxes and literacy texts to assert white supremacy. In the first part of the 20th century, the church was eager to improve race relations and promote charitable causes, but only within the context of Jim Crow segregation. St. Paul's members were involved in redlining that prevented blacks from purchasing homes in white neighborhoods and in the decision to construct a highway through the heart of the thriving African-American business community. However, in recent decades, St. Paul's has incubated important efforts such as the MICA initiative, which inspired scores of area congregations to support elementary school children and teachers, particularly in high poverty areas. And members of the congregation were also instrumental in the development and support of Hope in the Cities as we launched our campaign for honest conversation on race, reconciliation, and responsibility, including Richmond's first walk through its racial history. Many of the congregation took part in small group dialogues. And in 2018, the church held a public forum entitled Bending Towards Truth, a forum on race and religion in Richmond, with 500 people from all denominations. Presiding Bishop Michael Curry spoke at a service of remembrance and repentance. And the church is now considering what tangible reparations it can make to the Richmond community. Our historian, Chris Graham, has completed a book documenting the process, Blind Spots, Race and Identity in the Southern Church. In conclusion, I believe that the greatest challenge facing communities everywhere is how to tell hard truth without blame or accusation, and how to do this in ways that brings people together to work for solutions, for profound changes in policies, priorities, and structures. A fearless uncovering of lies, false narratives, and most importantly, courageous facing of our own past, our own responsibility for the problems in our communities, and the recognition that we are all on a journey. This graphic describes the process of trust building and building the capacity of community leaders in all sectors that Richmond developed as a training model for community leaders. It also provides the frame for my book. And it really, you can look at it here as three sort of four components. Firstly, how do we develop personal practices that build trust and promote sustainable change? And the core principle here is change starts with me, not with the other person. Secondly, how do we acknowledge and heal historic wounds and wounded memory, honoring different stories and identities, which are necessary steps in creating new shared narratives and building movements to address legacies of inequity? Thirdly, building skills and guiding honest conversation skills for initiating and guiding honest conversations on difficult subjects. Courageous, inclusive, and honest conversations on difficult subjects enable the building of trust among stakeholders. It requires a readiness among all stakeholders to hold themselves, their communities, and institutions accountable, and to be willing to change where change is needed. And fourthly, diverse teams composed of representatives of all sectors create the most effective force for change. Taken together, these four components from our experience and our experience now in many other localities provide a basis for sustainable change, racial equity, and reconciliation. These methodologies are now the foundation for a leadership formation program which has expanded from Richmond to other cities and also to teams as we speak in South Africa, Kenya, France, Canada, Nepal, Australia, and Indonesia. Again, I could imagine that such a training could be useful for a community like Austin. So St. David's has embarked on a very important journey. And I believe that this church, with its unique history, could play a major role in the transformation of this city. And the question, I think, is, what is the honest conversation that is most needed in this church and in the wider community? I believe that truly honest conversation can lead to change in individuals, in relationships, and if sustained, to change in society. Because it moves us to action. It touches us at our deepest point of motivation. Creating space for change in our communities is an art in which we are all learners. It requires skills of the head and of the heart. By identifying and releasing personal baggage, in the words of John Coleman, we can create a welcoming environment for others. Through inclusive dialogue, we can hear each other's stories and invite others to join our journey. In acknowledging painful history, we can move towards understanding, shared responsibility, and ultimate forgiveness and reconciliation. And through genuine partnerships and sustained teamwork, we can begin to build trust and bring about change where it is most difficult and most needed. So with that, I'm going to stop talking. And I think, Doug, we have some time for questions. We have about 15 minutes for questions. I think Ulrika is also keeping track of the chat room.
Other people can raise their hands.
People can raise their hands. I need to close the slideshow. Hang on.
Stop sharing.
Yeah, but I'm not seeing the stop sharing line.
You're going to cover it now.
It seems to have frozen. The laptop seems to be frozen there.
Let's see.
Because there's no, I don't see any way here of, even though I hit escape, it's not.
You want it? No, I can get you up here, I think.
Can we get out of, stop share, hit stop share.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to work up to. There we go.
There we go. Get the stop share. There we go. Okay. Minor technical glitch there. Okay. So, anybody have comments, questions, thoughts, ideas?
Broadwell, they get their questions. I do have a question for you. So, Reverend Sandy here, when we see if you can
come up here,
yeah,
sure,
so that everyone can hear me.
Good.
So, my question, Rob, is: we live in a culture of outrage and easily canceling one another. And I'm wondering, how do we move beyond that to engage in honest conversations? And what goes beyond just listening and actually engaging in conversation? I just want to hear your opinion and your experience.
I understand the outrage, because there's a lot to be outraged about in many ways. I think somehow we have to recognize that all of us are on a learning journey, you know, and that even the person who we may very much disagree with may have some important experience in their life, some kernel of truth which we can pay attention to. So I think if we can get into conversation where we're talking also about personal experiences and not just theories and policies, I think that's a help, you know, because everybody, you know, everybody in many ways has experiences they may be able to relate to each other. I think there's no easy answer to that one. I think it's very important that we learn how to do it in different ways. Because I don't see any way that we're going to get to sustainable change if we remain locked in our silos, where I'm only going to talk with the people I agree with, and I'm not going to talk with the people I disagree with. Change is simply not going to happen. And so we have to sort of, in a way, I think, approach this with a little humility and recognize that, you know, we don't have all the answers. We have to find a way of speaking truth without condemnation, right? I mean, I think one of the important aspects of the work that was going on in Richmond around the acknowledging of history was being able to do that without a sense of accusation or blame or guilt, right? Simply coming together to be able to tell the story in different ways. And so how do we do that? I think it's going to be different in different places, but I think your question is a really, really important one that is often a missing factor in many ways. I mean, other folks on this call may have insights on that question too, because I think it really goes to the heart of a lot of our issues right now.
Go ahead, Joan, you'll just have to unmute.
Rob, I wanted to ask you about the walk through history that you did with the whole city. That was so powerful. I wonder if you continue to do it other years, or how does that work there?
Yes. So I mean, what's happened now is that this is a sort of ongoing thing that many, many, many different groups experience this in different ways, right? I mean, the city, as a result of that first walk, the city established what we call the Slave Trail Commission, because that first walk was really marking the route of enslaved people into Richmond. That has been developed as a sort of educational resource, so that now schools, churches, different organizations regularly walk that route. There's now a virtual guide that you can follow. We have people coming from other cities to do this walk. We've had people coming from other countries to do that walk. You know, it's been powerful with people from the Middle East, black and white from South Africa, because in a way they can all relate to that need to be able to tell the story. It's an ongoing thing. It's a powerful resource now in the Richmond community.
Got a comment too.
John.
Yeah. So one of the key questions or one of the key things that we're talking about here is that everybody has to do something. Yeah. It's up to us to do something about our situation, to change us and to change people around us. So I have a couple of recommendations. First of all, there's the Union of Black Episcopalians, which would love to have you as a member, or your church as a member. And it's not
it's not exclusive for African-American people. It's just the Union of Black Episcopalians is very powerful around the state doing a lot of things. The other thing is we need to get engaged with other churches. For instance, there's a Catholic church on 12th Street, Holy Ghost, I believe it is, that is has racial reconciliation meetings once a month. So you can attend those. They're open to the public. There's you also can go to another church one day just to see what how things are going there. So there's a lot that we have to do, but I think the most important point is we have to do it. We individually have to do it. We can't sit around and wait for some organization to do it. It's up to us.
Thank you, Doug. Really, really important.
I was just going to say the meeting at Holy Cross is Tuesday night. So it's Holy Cross Catholic Church Courageous Conversations.
Good.
I'm assuming you can just go to their website. I get their emails, so sorry, I'm not. But yeah, I think if you just go to Holy Cross Catholic and scroll or whatever, but it's Tuesday night at 6:30. So it's coming up. And the Union of Black Episcopalians, and I'm drawing a blank, does trainings in Austin based on a PBS show, Race, the Power of an Illusion. Ah, One Human Race. It just came to me.
Yes.
Yeah. And I also recommend those. So you can just Google One Human Race or DuckDuckGo if you don't Google, which I don't anymore. So that's it.
Thank you.
Good resources.
Anybody else would like to speak?
And really, it can be a comment as well. It could be a question, it could be a comment or sharing an experience. I appreciated what Rob said about small steps. That is so important because I found myself becoming so impatient with the progress, but it's important to acknowledge all the small things that we're doing. And I see Marianne raised her hand. So Marianne, go ahead.
I really appreciate all the Rob sharing with us all the experiences, all the learning that comes from just years and years of hard work. And I just wanted to sort of touch back on something that he said, which was that it really comes down to, do we really believe that each individual person deserves dignity, has dignity, you know? And so for me, I think that that's, for me, been a really good starting point is, yes, I believe everyone is a beloved child of God. But how does that play out for me in the way I actually look at other people and the way that I actually treat them, and how that's a simple proposition, but it's much harder to live and to parse out than it sounds. And and I think, that there's also like wisdom to be gotten on that same idea in other areas where people have been doing a lot of hard work too, like in disability rights and in, the LBGQ communities struggles. I think that, it's not just that I have to change myself on the issue of race. And this is, I think, what's maybe scary is that it's way bigger than that. It's like, I have to change myself in everything. And the way I think about each person in everything, but for me, that's a big starting point for me, big area for me to look at within myself.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And I'm glad you highlighted the question of dignity, which is so important, because I think
you know, if a person feels that their dignity is not being respected, they are not going to be become part of that conversation. You know, a lot of the problems that we have in many of our communities are the result of people who feel they have not been respected, that their dignity is not respected. And how we do that, you know, I think is really a key to really unlocking some of the really tough situations we have. So I appreciate that you put that one on the table.
Go ahead, Donna.
Oh, thank you. I think, like many white people, I am in pain whenever I observe that, yes, my white privilege exists, and that white privilege playing out in the world causes very great damage to people who are not sharing white privilege. And I am particularly delighted to have heard several people mention resources that are available, because I, as a well-intentioned white person, stumble right on that step that says, okay, but what do I do about it? Where do I find some way to engage myself with this process? And I am thinking that it would not be insuperably difficult to compile a list of these resources that could be simply set on a tabletop somewhere, and anybody else who is in the same place of pain might be able to pick up a little brochure or something, a piece of paper that says, join the Union of Black Episcopalians. What does the Union of Black Episcopalians do? Well, they have trainings based upon one human race. This is stuff I didn't hear about before today. And Holy Cross, Courageous Conversations. We can compile something.
That's a good idea. Great.
I think also we have to, in many situations, we have to find a way to sort of, you might say, connect the dots and work strategically. I was meeting the other day with a senior advisor to the mayor who's been leading a racial equity project within the city. And one of the things he commented was the extent to which people are working in silos, different organizations who have no idea that someone might be doing similar types of work, or that someone might be actually a very useful resource or partner. You know, and this is particularly true in the nonprofit world, but it's probably true in other areas also. You know, we're so busy doing what we're doing that we're not paying attention. We're not taking time to actually find out what other people are doing and how we might collaborate with them. You know, a lot of our most important work in Richmond was when we were playing the role the sort of unspoken role, the silent partner, right? The silent partner. Several occasions where we were supporting other organizations in what they were doing without any recognition for our organization at all, but simply enabling them to do their best work. There was a wise man who once said, you know, tea is not sweetened until the lump of sugar is dissolved. And I think one of the problems in our society is we have this tremendous drive for recognition. And how do we sort of focus more on how can we support other people and encourage other people? And how can we learn from them? I think that way our collaborative efforts would be a lot stronger. Okay. Unless there's any more
questions?
Well, I just wanted to say from my own experience of working with St. David's and the beloved community that I've been very excited because All Saints has been on the same journey and has now a racial reconciliation ministry. And I hate to put Anne on the spot, but I am going to ask her to say a few words about it because we've talked a lot about ways that St. David's and All Saints can work together, and hopefully St. James, and looking at our three downtown Episcopal churches that can work with other entities. So Can I ask Ann to say a few words about it?
Sure, and I'm so happy to see so many All Saints people on this call. Hi, Martha and Lana and Sarah Pete, who you can't see, and Marianne Corbett. We started this work last spring as a result of enthusiasm in the congregation. It came out of a conversation circle that was sponsored by Central Texas Interfaith, Kathleen. And boy, we've got a lot of energy. So we are trying to learn as much as we can, as quickly as we can. We are putting resources up on our website. Many of us are doing a book study this summer on Waking Up White. We've done a lot of the programs all St. David's has offered, and some of us are going to be trained in the Beloved Community Sacred Ground training this fall. We're also hoping to bring in a speaker for our annual Bailey Lecture. She's a African-American woman from Houston who, if you saw it in the Episcopal newsletter for the Diocese of Texas, the history of the Diocese of Texas and the racial history, and it's pretty painful. Her name is Kathy Culmer, and she will be speaking for a weekend in December, and we'll get the word to everybody. And it's going to be about how do we engage our stories, our own experiences, to do that inner transformation. And Marianne, you're on that committee. You may know more than I do.
Yeah, we're still pretty much at the early planning stage. And unfortunately, I missed the meeting, but our first meeting. But it looks like it'll be December 3rd through the 5th. And so there'll be a thing on Friday evening, including a reception. There'll be a workshop on Saturday morning. And then Kathy will preach at our Sunday service. And then we'll also have a session after the Sunday service and the adult faith formation time. So we're really excited that we're going to be able to get her to come. She's a fantastic speaker and very, very knowledgeable about the history of race in our diocese. And she's very, very keyed in on like holding, she's just from what I have seen and heard, she really is, believes in our responsibility if we really are Christians to take a good hard look at this and to respond to it. So, so I think it'll be really good when she, you know, in December.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I think our hour is about up. I did want to mention that St. David's will be doing the healing circles starting on the 12th of September. And it's a 12-week series, mostly based on history of racism from the very beginning when the Pilgrims landed all the way up through modern day racism that's in America. So it's a really good series, and we hope people will sign up. We'll have the sign up this week where you can get registered for that. We have been working real closely with All Saints, and I think it's a great idea that we, you know, get out of our silos and get to know other people. So I appreciate all the folks that have showed up tonight from All Saints. So anyway, without further ado, I think we'll end the meeting. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming. And we'll keep doing things. Let's give a hand for Rob, too.
Thank you.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.